Good morning, everyone. So this is not a prepared lecture. So we only talked about this yesterday. I will not have slides or anything. So I just write on some sketches on the blackboard as we go along. So planet formation is an event in the context of star formation. And to what we believe right now, so of course we are doing scientists, what we think that we know is there's a fundamental difference between planet formation and star formation. So star formation is like casting a bell. So there's a big form, which is basically gravity, and then simply some material is getting dumped into it, so it's one process. And then the thing is basically finished in its mass and size, is only slowly evolving. So building a planet in contrast to this is more like manufacturing a car. So which means there are gazillions of little things being assembled somewhere, being transported to some other place, built into some other things. You have things made of plastic, things made of metal. So there's a late marriage between the engine part and all the framework of the car. So it's a multi-stage process, which also makes it more complicated to study all the individual processes to see what planets form. But everything starts, as I said, with star formation. So we have the good knowledge that our planetary system is as old as the Sun, where I have to remark that of course the age of the oldest grains in the solar system is much better known than what we know about the age of the Sun. So people doing doing stellar evolution codes, they are basically now fine-tuning their evolution stuff and convection models in the Sun based on what they know from the oldest grains in the solar system. So, of course, basically we think things are starting together. What you have before there's a Sun and before you have and before you have planets, there's some molecular cloud core, so somewhere floating around in the star formation region in our galaxy, and this thing is stabilized by pressure, and at the same time gravity tries to pull the thing together. And as long as the thing is somehow in equilibrium, it does not collapse. As soon as it cools down, or pressure can also be magnetic pressure, or on the other hand, magnetic fields decay, or things are getting pushed from the outside, densities are reached, and things are starting to collapse.
What's the origin of the pressure? Radiation pressure?
Step number one is thermal pressure. But thermal pressure is pretty often not sufficient. Then you have on top of this magnetic pressure. And the third thing is kinematic pressure, so that you have high Mach number gas at Mach numbers of 3, 4, 5. And this keeps the thing alive. But I have to say,
so this thing's pretty hot.
Yes, like 10K, 10K, 20K, so very hot. Hot enough, so to be stabilized. Yeah, but also their problem starts. So like 10 years ago, people thought they had understood star formation, especially low-mass star formation, and now they still think again it's not really known. For instance, we do not know whether this has to be triggered by a supernova wave which is running across it, or it's just randomly collapsing, so a lot of open question here. So of course, if you have a gravity collapse, you could think, why not forming a singularity? The first problem that you run into is, of course, magnetic fields. They are taking care that everything goes a little bit slower. And the other point which you have in here is angular momentum, so which I just call L phi. This means the entire thing is, even at a very low spinning, let's say it's spinning at the frequency omega, at a very low rate, even if we are just putting in here the number for the galactic rotation, which you know it only has rotated two handful of times since its life, so it's really a slow rotator. But if you are contracting such a thing and you're conserving angular momentum, then you cannot simply form into a singularity, which would be a star. No, especially the high angular momentum material is falling into a disk. So you're forming an object where the center, the most of the mass, is sitting here in the center. So it's here the stellar mass. And most of the angular momentum of the thing is located in the disk. So that's basically the initial condition for star formation, for planet formation. The idea that things have been forming in a disk is even much older. So in already Kant and Laplace, if we are going back to those old philosophers, they had the idea that as all the planets are in one plane, they also should have formed something in geometry which fits into this plane. So they had no idea how this comes into life. There they were pretty much wrong. They thought it would have been a second star flying by, pulling material out of the young sun and such things. So this is basically the initial condition for planet formation. And this is an observed initial condition for planet formation. So we see that all young stars are surrounded by more or less dust and gas material. So if you're, for instance, looking for evolution of the age of system, so and you put in here, let's say, that's units of 10 to 6 years, and this is then 1, 2, 3, down here, let's say, to 10. And this is a probability that you're detecting a disk around such a thing, so from base from Earth-based telescopes, but also lately the Herschel satellite put out and Spitzer put out a lot of disks in there, then you see that you have a decreasing probability so to detect such a disk around a young star.
Exponentially or by power?
Sorry?
Exponentially decreasing probability.
This is observational stuff. You can fit anything to it what you like, so. It's not really known. So
this is a linear scale.
Yeah, the point is that the error bars are here like this and here, so.
It's a linear scale. It's
yes, I did not put any scale on here, yes. It's really gigantic error bars. And also, if you go to another star forming region, it might look like this. So this is what astronomers then call, it's a trend. So,
right. Decreases.
It decreases, yes. And you know that roughly after 10 million years or so, then all material is gone. There's a warning, of course, what in most of these simulations is being detected is just the content of dust in your disk. So you have no idea whether there's gas remnants in there and so on. So this is one observation constraint. The other one is that young stars, astronomy. So a star.
By the way, how close to one does this probability actually go?
Sorry?
How close to one does this
probability? Ooh, 80-90%.
Yeah.
So of course you can already think about, so why are not all disks initially the same? But then it's really the question of how much angular momentum was available in this thing. And of course, it's not a sphere which is collapsing as many numericists do, but it's a turbulent medium. So there are a lot of accretion events. And then whenever you're accreting high angular momentum material, you're putting more on the disk. If it's low angular momentum material, you're putting things in the inner part. But we come to the initial conditions here again a little bit later. So if you're observing a star, then basically you have here a black body spectrum. So if this is here wavelength, and this here is somehow the wavelength-dependent intensity which comes from the star. So this would be infrared stuff. This would be ultraviolet. So if you see a black body, then it's a naked star, as we say. And if there's an infrared excess, somehow like this, then this means there comes more infrared radiation, and this was the first indication that there's dusty material around this star. So that's the infrared excess. At the same time, you observe something funny, which is an excess on the other side. This is ultraviolet. So there's more ultraviolet radiation coming from the star than you would anticipate from its temperature, which you can estimate just by the maximum here in this, in the spectral energy distribution, Wien's law and that stuff.
The star is already hot.
The star is already hot, yes. So.
But when does supernova start?
Yes. it starts after, well, yeah, I didn't want to go into interstellar evolution part. So it's not really important here. So
it's burning.
It's already burning here. But it is burning. The G-taurids are burning, but they are still getting some energy by contraction. So those things are like 3 to 5 times larger than our sun, but in their center they are already burning hydrogen. So and then it's a continual process. So if you go to this scale, then somewhere in the middle of this here, they have contracted to the main sequence.
What's so the time? So it depends whether you're 1 or 10.
Sorry?
So it depends whether it's 1 million or it's 10 million.
Yeah, it does not. Yeah, a little bit. Yes, right. So they're approaching somewhere. But for the planet formation process, it does not have a major influence. For instance, the luminosity of the thing does not much change. So basically, the color changes. So it's a little bit redder in the beginning, and in the end, it's green as we have it today. So this ultraviolet radiation cannot be produced by the star, but it's produced by the material from the disk which is falling onto the star. So, and that's just the release of gravitational energy of material here falling onto the star. But as we said, angular momentum is so important. Angular momentum can only be released if there are some viscous process, turbulent processes in the disk. This is what makes our entire disk turbulence. But we come to this a little bit later. So now we have also the measurement. We can observe here not only this continuum, but also certain lines. This is called H alpha line. And this the width of this line tells you how much energy is released in the falling of the material onto the star. And from this, you can derive what the m dot, that's what we call the accretion rate, is of material falling from the disk onto the star. And there again, you see a trend very similar to this one. You have here an m dot. You have here your h's, again, 10 to 6 in units. Let's do this logarithmic here, 10 to 7, 10 to 5. And here you also see a trend that the accretion rate decays over time. So this already indicates you that this decay here in the probability to detect the disk is related to mass flowing from the disk onto the star. So this is the first process, so which decreases the mass of the disk and the probability to detect it. And this is accretion. Then a second process which occurs is that the radiation of the star is starting to blow away material. And this is not simply the radiation pressure. It's really individual photons which are kicking out the hydrogen atoms from the disk. So you really need energetic photons. And then whatever hydrogen molecule or they find out there, it's being kicked out. So
kicked out all the way out of gravity.
Exactly, yes, right. So, and this effect is called photo evaporation.
This Rengen, I mean, what kind of...
Sorry?
What kind of photons you need for this?
anything which is high in energy, UV, and sometimes... Yeah. And of course, it starts. This evaporation does not start at the innermost part, but at the outermost part of the disk, where they are the loosest bound to the entire system.
It's optically thick or it's transparent?
The disk. Yeah. The disk is highly optically thick. Uh-huh. So radiation has to propagate along the surface of the disk. So I have not said, I have not told you this, besides having this indirect information of that there are disks, because based on this infrared excess, you also have observations. Just 1 second. So that you also have observations of these things, so which are resolved. And then a typical picture which you have is there somehow such a disky thing which is black, so you cannot see anything in here.
Frequency range in infrared.
Sorry.
Any frequency range, so you can look at the.
No. Well, this is done in the near infrared, or basically in the optical.
Infrared.
So, and. What you see then here is basically some radiation of the star coming out here. So that's just a sketch. And so you assume that there must be a star somewhere in there, and you see a big shadow. And this is just the dust grains which have absorbed everything. If you're now starting to do infrared, then you see a huge glow. You're not spatially resolved it anymore, so Abbe's law. But at the same time, you see that there's a lot of radiation coming in for infrared, and that's basically this measurement here. Yes?
You said two things which appear on the surface to be contradictory.
Okay.
You said that material is first removed from the outer regions of the disk system. Mm-hmm. Because it's more loosely bound. But you also said that the disk is optically thick.
Yes.
Which means that the high energy photons in particular, mm-hmm, would have a hard job getting to the outside of the,
yeah,
disk.
So
I'm wondering if you could resolve that.
Yes. The point is that if you're looking at a disk surface, then you have everywhere in your disk basically an equilibrium again between pressure, which is pointing up, and gravity, which is pointing down. And gravity in this case is originating from the star, but all the radial component is compensated by the rotation. This means you have effectively a vertical component of gravity. The thermal pressure decays at some power law, but at some other power law, your gravity is decaying. And this leads basically effectively to what the astronomers call a flared disk. So, and this gives you the possibility that basically at each radius you're intercepting. Sorry?
What is the line?
That's basically an optical surface, a photosphere of the disk, where things are getting absorbed. So in the real world, it's a little bit more wiggly in here, but basically at large scale heights, at large distances, the disk is flaring. Also,
it means it's very hot.
Sorry?
It's also very hot there.
No, again, you're only at 10 or 20 Kelvin. So it's extremely cold
like
in here.
The sun, right. No, this means the geometry.
Yeah.
So you have all these photons hitting this thing, that doesn't you're
right. So this individual hydrogen molecule, which is hit by a photon, is itself very hot. So they are also talking there about superheating. So this single thing is heated to so high temperatures that it basically escapes from the system. So this one is hot. But this heat is not communicated to the rest of the gas.
They don't,
right,
just,
yes.
Just goes away.
Right, exactly.
If you try to do a self-consistent calculation, you calculate the shape of the disk given the irradiation field.
Yes, you also incorporate this. Yes.
So right. It does modify the shape.
Yeah. And also there's not only this the theoretical concept that they must be flaring, also if you are calculating the infrared flux for certain objects, then you see that you need flaring in order to get the proper infrared shape. So, okay, so the disk is, a second process is photo evaporation, and the third process is also, it's only mentioned here by to have a complete picture, this is basically planet formation, but as we said, we do not know whether planets are forming in those. That's the topic of the discussion today. So I put just a question mark in here. So because we do not see that really mass is disappearing in these planets. There's, just to be complete, there are some objects where you see outflow coming from the thing. So there's material at very high velocities shooting in the rotational axis out of the system. But I always say this is just the fireworks. This is not really related to the formation of planets. It really takes care at a few stellar radii away from the star, where magnetic field lines are so strongly twisted that material gets, by magnetocentrifugal acceleration, shot out of the entire system. A part of your mass accretion rate, which is coming from the disk and wants to flow onto the star, is by this process being ejected from the system, but only a fraction. Some people say it's a third, but actually this value is not really good known. So just an astronomical
measurement. You're saying the jet is really a consequence of the stellar wind rather than a disk wind?
No, I didn't say this. No,
yeah, I
said a few stellar radii away. So it's basically the place where the magnetic dipole field of the star is enough to break the disk apart. So basically, so it's a disk.
It comes from the innermost edge of the disk, which you think
right.
Is only three radii.
So the picture of this is like you have a star in the center, you have a disk which extends to some radius down to the star. At some point, the magnetic pressure does not allow for a disk anymore, then material is at some fraction flowing onto the star. That's the accretion. And some of the material, because you have also the field lines in here, gets then basically ejected out of the system. So, right. So, and it comes, what we believe right now, from the inner part of the disk. There are the specialists in this field will of course contradict each other. So some people call it's just coming from one very narrow radius. That's the X-wind model, which originally had the idea that it comes even from the surface of the star. But now even the X points, the has has moved a little bit away from the star, and some more disky people say it's a variety of radii where this jet comes from, but it's not really important. So anything what is related to planet formation only starts at larger radii. Okay, and why is this? The point is that out to a distance, let's say, of 0.1 down to 1 astronomical units, and 1 astronomical unit just the distance of the Earth to the Sun, there the gas is so hot, not only by the irradiation of the star, but also by the mass transport in the disk, that there are basically no dust grains are available. Then you have a second region of the disk, which extends roughly out to 4.0 AU, but this also is a function of how strongly the thing is accreting, where you have dust grains, so I call this dust, and then at even larger radii, you have two things in here, this is dust and ice. So 4 AU, this is basically the inner solar system, the 5 AU is where Jupiter is located, there is also dust and ice available. And this means already here you are at a temperature of 150 Kelvin. That's the temperature that you have in the solar nebula to have ice, so there's lower pressure.
The temperature profile look in the D region.
Sorry?
In the D region, what is the temperature profile looking?
Well, it goes here from roughly 1,000 Kelvin down to here 150.
Exponential, or how does it?
Oh, no, it's some geometric power law, so. It depends on your opacities. So yeah, it somehow varies between R to the minus 1 and can be shallower to, how do you say this?
So how can planets closer than the Earth to the Sun? If there is no even dust there in this region.
Yes, I will mention this a little bit later. So I can already tell you, you're fabricating them at some other radii and then you transfer them to this radius. So, good. Now we have the observation, there are disks, they are somehow accreting, so they must be turbulent, they are disappearing after some time, so what goes on in this disk?
So when you want to accrete, when you think about planets, we think about them as being a solid material.
Yes.
Which is fused by high pressure and high temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this region there, the 1,000 Kelvin, it's pretty cold. Are the pressures enormous? I mean, are they huge? Would it sit here? I mean, could I make a piece of granite out there? I mean, can I actually take this dust and
words
and actually make out of the dust the solid piece?
No. The material entering this region, most of this material is at very small sizes. So this means really it evaporates. It does not have a long time to survive.
I understand that, but
yes.
If I move away, you would tell us how to make.
Yeah. Okay. Good. So okay, you're starting your initial. So that's basically the history of dust. So there is dust.
What is the chemical composition and the size of the particles?
Yes, exactly.
Can you talk
so
about that?
So dust is already observed in this wonderful molecular cloud out here, and even molecules are existing. So there's in astronomy and especially in theoretical astrophysics, there are only three species of matter, which is hydrogen, helium, and metals. And metals is all things
metals,
which are larger than helium. But if you look more closely to it,
helium is not. Helium is a metal. Yeah.
No.
Helium is helium. Anything bigger than helium is a metal.
So if you're adding up the mass content in hydrogen and in helium, then hydrogen can be molecular and atomic. So then this makes up roughly to 98% of the material available in space. And out of this 2%, now you have this mass distribution of all your other elements. And
3% is in mass, or?
This is in mass, yes, in mass. So in number, it's even higher, yes. We are always working here with simple dust grains, which we also have a good relation to, which is silicates like SiO2. So sand grains, so this is a major constituent. And then depending on what other metals are mixed in there, you have all these posterites and olivines and all these funny dust grains. So they are making up here, we say here, roughly like 1%. So these are solid grains. And well, people do not really agree on numbers, so I make it simpler here. So this is 79%. And then there's something which we call ice. And this is 1%. And these are things like H2O and other things which are sticky and gluey in this nebula, to keep things simple here.
So are there any other gases out there?
Any other gases? Sorry?
I don't know. Carbon is not out there.
Yes, so carbon monoxide is one of the favorite gases, and which you're also observing. It's in part, there are things like it's either in the gas phase or at cold temperature, it can be frozen out on the dust grains. And these are huge topics in research because the abundances never really fit. And so they have to argue, why is it not all out frozen, but some are still floating around. So huge topics.
And what about iron? I thought that was the most stable.
Yes, it is. So that's also why the value I give you here is solar metallicity. So this is what we assume. We do not exactly know, but this is what we assume, that our entire solar system, including sun and planets, is constituted. And this is what we translate into then metallicity. And metallicity is always given in the iron to hydrogen ratio, so in the system. And this value is defined to be, the logarithm of this is then the metallicity. And for the sun, it's defined to be 1. But as I said, so iron is some of the constituents then here in your grains, because it's the most stable, but it's certainly not the most abundant thing here. So first, it's only present in some grains here. So the initial dust size distribution, which we know from this interstellar medium and then also from the molecular clouds, so these are things in the order of, let's say here, 0.1 micrometer. So they are really, really tiny grains which are floating around there. But they are already starting by Brownian motion driven to collide in the molecular cloud. And as the densities increase in this wonderful nebula here, so you had an initial density here. We always use grams for cubic centimeters. Here it's like 10 to minus what, 20? So, and we are in the outer part of the disk, we go up maybe to 10 to minus 13 grams per cubic centimeters. So we are still in this SI system here. I have to apologize. So density has increased dramatically. And then the first step which we have is called coagulation. And coagulation means that, driven by Brownian motion, dust grains are colliding to each other. They are very sticky. And they are not sticky just because of, not because there is some glue on the surface or so, but it's simply the surface tension. If you have such a tiny glass sphere, it will stick together just because it's deforming the surface as two things are touching each other. So, and in this process, you're forming larger and larger things, let's say up to millimeters. So they are, of course.
So the particles at 0.1 micron has such a high.
Yes. They have an absolutely high stickiness. Yes. Wow. So
if you want to put any papers, anything in here, IR, there are sticks. But immediately happens anything below 1 micron is hopeless. You have to have it in water or in liquids. Yeah. Put them in the gas, they always stick to each other. Okay. Electrostatically or.
It's just you get your fill stage.
Yeah.
But at 1 micron, you can have them kind of separate. At 20 microns is easy.
But but at 1 micron, it's really difficult already to separate
them. But anything that's like 10 microns or something, you can have as a powder.
Yeah. So we were doing.
Microns, you can have as a powder. But everything else comes in liquid if you want to.
Their velocity, their thermal velocity in the Brownian motion is quite small.
Yes.
The inner particle distance is quite large.
Right.
And does it make sense that they should actually coagulate given?
Yes.
We take a mean distance and divide it by your diffusivity, and what is the time scale that I get? Square distance divided by diffusivity.
So this is basically then a few thousand years. Yes. So this is what you can translate then into a closed time scale, and one rough number would be really then 10^3 to 10^4 years, where you are growing your material into the next size bin. So starting from 1 micron into 2 micron, and it's really an exponential process. So because then a second effect comes, of course your Brownian motion gets smaller and smaller as your particles get larger, but at the same time they suddenly recognize that they are suspended in an atmosphere and they are starting to sediment towards the midplane. And then the same happens as outside in nature on Earth, that snowflakes which are forming are not staying suspended in the air, but they are starting to sediment. And as they are sedimenting, they are sweeping up smaller things. And this is the second growth motion. So coagulation first driven by Brownian motion, then by sedimentation, then the next effect is radial drift of this material, and finally also turbulence in the disk is generating relative velocities to each other. And the growth sizes up to which you get, I just want to give you here, is somewhere in the order of 1 millimeter to 10 centimeters. And the problem here really is, what are the collision speeds between those things?
What you now assume is that, what you have to assume is that you have these very small, there's basically a background of very, very small particles, which are 0.1 microns or something, which stick well. And
yeah.
So if you have a big particle going through, it will collect those.
Basically, yes.
Right. And even once you get to the 1 millimeter region and these two guys hit each other, then these are these two particles which have what is sintered. It's like a sintered material, basically.
Therefore, you need high temperatures, which you don't have out there. So.
Okay, exactly.
And you also do not sinter in this millisecond where you have to bounce.
It's a very
right.
thing that sticks by surface tension.
Right. And it's a, that's why I said snowflakes. So these are fluffy aggregates. So this means their sticking probabilities are still the same as among the individual micron-sized dust grains.
But they wouldn't be snowflakes. They would be...
They are dust flakes.
Balls.
But as I said here, no, they are not balls. They can be in the when.
It's like loose.
Yeah, I think even sod is more compact. So you can have this. It's really a big question what the filling factor of these things is. So in the beginning they thought they would be really fractals. So really getting, not changing their surface, increasing their surface even in as they were growing, if they are really like needles. And but now they think that at some point collisions will reform them so that they are very fluffy flakes. So very irregular.
I understand that the measurements are probably very difficult to do.
The experimental measurements.
Yeah, but this scenario of coagulation and accretion, there is an associated prediction for the aggregate size distribution. Are there measurements of that?
For the nebula. So what you do in the synthetic size?
The grain sizes.
Yeah.
Resulting from a coagulation process.
Yes.
There is an average size which increases in time.
Yes, right.
So a distribution of sizes around this average.
Exactly. So this if you put this closed scenario into evolution equation, which is the Smoluchowski equation
exactly,
for this case,
exactly.
And then you get out certain shapes in your size distribution.
Yeah.
You see where the mass is locating. You see over what sizes your particle sizes are spread.
But this is consistent with what is observed.
This is difficult to say because you always, depending on what wavelengths you look in, you see other particle sizes, and it's not really unique to translate one spectral energy distribution into one particle size distribution. So people are always doing this and even playing around with, I put in a little bit more of the large ones, of the smaller ones, but you have too little information and too many free parameters. So, but the general trend, what is observed is that that in some older disks, there must be at least millimeter-sized dust grains. So this is conserved, because then this gives you different spectral features which are observed. So this is an observational fact which was then also published under the highlights, Planet Formation Observed, because they really could show, and this was the first time, that one had jumped from micrometers to millimeters. in the disk. So, or this is at least known, right? But you had something, yes.
You said that the gas is turbulence. Could you tell us something about the turbulence?
Oh, yes.
In particular, what is the integral velocity scale?
Yes. So, of course, indication about turbulence first just came from this wonderful observation of the accretion flow onto this stuff. And then by having describing how this could be driven, one came up with a viscosity model saying that the accretion rate that you observe is proportional to the viscosity in your disk times the local surface density. So this is roughly then what gives you the mass flux from the disk onto the star. And as you want to have a long-lived process, this must be the same accretion rate all over the disk. That's the simplest approximation, that your mass accretion rate does not vary, that you have a continuous flow of material. So this viscosity here is basically then a velocity times a length scale. So we talked about this yesterday, so roughly a mixing model of momentum. And if you're thinking about what are the typical realistic velocities that you can have in there, especially if you roughly think what are reasonable surface densities that fit observation and stability criteria for the disk, then you come up that this can be only a fraction of the sound speed. It only has to be a fraction of the sound speed. And L, what is the length scale of a disk? And there it's really convenient to talk about here about the pressure scale height. I'll put it in here. So it's a vertical pressure scale height, H, which is indicating you after what height in your atmosphere your pressure has dropped by an E-folding value. Right. So the typical length here is h, and this is a turbulent velocity. And now how to do the jump. At the same time, h can be approximated as the local sound speed divided by the Keplerian frequency at this radius. Then you can also say that I'm scaling here my turbulent velocity on the sound speed, and I have a proportionality factor which is called alpha. So then I have a viscosity in here which is alpha times CS squared over omega. And values which are helping you to explain the time-dependent accretion rate of this disk are somewhere in the order of, let's say, 10 to minus 2 to 10 to minus 3.
This alpha is not a Mach number, it's something else?
Yes, now we're coming to this. It's basically now the square root. So so alpha, it's difficult, yes. So I put it in this way. You see, I have here velocity squared. So because now we have no idea what the integral scale of the turbulence is. So now you have two possibilities in here. You can now either say that the integral scale of the turbulence is a pressure scale height, h. So L is equals h. And then out of this follows that the turbulent velocity is, alpha times Cs, which then would mean that alpha is just a Mach number. And the other possibility is that just the second possibility is that you have your pressure scale height. It's just the square root of alpha times h. And also then only the square root of alpha would be the Mach number Cs.
Okay.
And this basically both formulation give you a unique alpha ansatz. And we have really not specified what the properties of the turbulence are. Things are even now, so coming to your question, so you see it's basically in the range between a few percent of the sound speed. These are your typical turbulent velocities that you have in the disk.
And the sound speed is what?
The sound speed at room temperature in the in the disk is around 1,000 meters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So dealing here, let's say, I would have been asked about a turbulent velocity, but of course this is a function of where you are in the disk. So, but saying like 50 meters per second, I think.
That's okay, good. That's that was what I was after.
Okay,
but
good.
The scale is huge, which means that the typical velocity gradients are very, very small. I mean, if I take velocity and divide by a typical scale, that would give me an inverse time.
Right.
Which would be what?
The funny thing is,
let's take any scenario.
Yeah. So in this scenario, it's especially nice because it's if you just take the ratio of those, then you get out that you're again with omega. So this means your rotation frequency of an eddy at 5 AU is 10 years.
Okay.
So it's really a gigantic slow motion thing.
Okay.
And if you're going then to this other regime, then you see things are even slower in rotation.
So it's comparable to the period of rotation
exactly.
Or even larger.
Or even larger, yes.
It's a typical turnover time of my large scale eddies.
Exactly, yes.
So it's not like
what
we have in mind. So this big one.
Yes.
Why did you write down the square roots there? Is that from a particular model?
No, I think you're ascribing a view.
Is there a particular turbulence model? Or
yes. So
the square root?
So this is what the correlation people like a lot. So like Jeff Kazi and so on.
It's
a square root model, yes. Because there you have always omega as your correlation time for the turbulence. And interestingly, if we're doing, and I talk about turbulence now very briefly, the correlation time really seems to be omega of the turbulence. So it's in the order of the orbital period. This is how your correlation time of the turbulence on the very large scales. But this is from numerical simulations. Under certain turbulence scenarios. And that's, again, the weak point. But now I talk about the three possibilities of turbulence. Yeah. So when the disk is forming, it's forming because of gravity. And as I said in the beginning, it's a lot of material can initially be dropped onto the disk. And if your disk is really massive in comparison to your star,
What needs to be emphasized is that this argument you there say speed is for the gas, right? This is not for the particles. As far as I understood,
yes, correct.
This is an argument for the gas, not for the more compactified dust.
Yes, right. So the there is then one particle size which has a
this is the effective. Yeah. So you're saying that this is for the.
That's the maximum collision speed that you can have between dust grains. So if they are perfectly coupling to the largest eddies, then this is the velocity they will obtain.
You know, I can show you. But what you can do is you can say if you just assume dust, there's a certain concentration, which really is centimeters squared per second, and you put in the granular viscosity instead of the gas viscosity, then what you get out, you get the same time scale. But you have to assume it's 50 meters per second. And it's a completely different formula. It doesn't have the square root of h, it doesn't have the square root of a. All it has is really the fluctuating velocity and the size of the grains.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you need. And the density difference to the gas. And then you can write down the granular viscosity, and that granular viscosity gives you same numbers.
Yeah. I'm curious. I want to see this.
Saying just looking at the particle,
the granular media, you know, when they shake granular medium, which is very dilute, you can write down the granular viscosity.
Yeah.
And this granular viscosity, when you take the mean free paths, you know, the collisions between these particles, when you say they don't stick, then you can write down a granular viscosity. And that viscosity, if you assume 50 meters per second, just comes out right, either by accident or it just comes out right.
And it's the viscosity in the momentum equation for the fluid.
For the fluid, for the effective, for this granular medium, If you assume there's no gas, you know, there's only granular medium, you shake it, and what you can say is, like, this fluid behaves like it has this viscosity, which is called the granular viscosity, and that one has been measured and, you know, analyzed for a dilute granular medium for the last 20 years or something. And if you take that number, then what you get is you get exactly the right numbers. If you assume that the velocity of the grains with each other, you know,
is of the order of 20 or 30 meters per second.
But why should they have such a high relative velocity?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's what you just said, too. Right?
Okay.
Then I don't need this argument with omega. All I need is the velocity and the size of the grains.
And there's no omega, and this will be
it's a granular medium, right? It's just a shaken granular medium.
And it assumes the particles are well coupled to the gas.
They're coupled then with the mean free parts. Yeah, sure. You have to be in the dilute limit. You have to be in the dilute limit where the product is. I can show you.
So if your viscosity is the same, it must mean that the mean free path is comparable to the correlation length of the turbulence. By magic, actually.
That's what I just want to say, though. It sounds like the injection scale of this turbulence.
Granular medium, you have to think about this.
Sure.
The cross section
of the board,
yeah.
Really.
But this is strange. So these are large distances.
Let's look at it.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay. So the first reason why disks are turbulent, or in other words, evolving, is self-gravity. So just like our galaxy has this wonderful spiral waves, we also believe that the youngest disks also had these spiral waves, which are transporting angular momentum very, very efficiently. So in the end,
gravity wins. Because you're saying that we mustn't forget that there is angular momentum, and
yes,
this is the reason why the shape would be like a disk. And
yes.
But in the end, gravity beats everybody.
It's no, temperature wins. The criterion I had introduced here, the quantity h, the pressure scale height, this basically tells you something. If you normalize this on the radius, h over r tells you then basically whether the disk is hot, then this is a large value, and if the disk is cold, it's a very small value. And roughly the value should be like 5 to 10%, depending on what the detailed process in your disks are. And when this value is roughly at the same order of here m disk to m star. So in this case, this is a critical ratio with respect to each other. If the disk mass is larger than whatever h over r gives you, then gravity is dominating. And when the disk mass is lower than this ratio, then suddenly the temperature is winning, and then you have basically a quiescent disk. So, and this already tells you, as the disk of the mass, the mass of the disk is decreasing, you have initially a very short, very violent self-gravity phase lasting for 10 to 5 years, depending on how much additional material is falling in this. And then the next couple of million years, you have to rely on something else. And so I said, turbulence 1 is self-gravity. The second process is now magnetohydrodynamics. So already in the very first description here of the turbulence, we are such an alpha ansatz, we have effective viscosity in the disk. Shakura and Zinyav not only considered the possibility to scale viscosity on the thermal pressure, but they also incorporated scaling it on the magnetic pressure. So there was already the knowledge that in these black hole accretion disks, which they were modeling at those days, magnetic fields might be important. But for a long time, it was not understood how magnetohydrodynamics can help you in disk accretion. The problem is when your fields are very strong, it's basically dominating the entire fluid. So if your magnetic pressure is so strong, then you have no disk. Your disk is simply getting destroyed. So, and on the other hand, they thought if there would be weak fields, it's difficult to say what happens then. They might not be important. So
the magnetic field is due to star.
Where do the fields come from? That's a very good question, and a lot of research is done about this. Nobody knows really. So one thing is, I said already that the initial disk here was penetrated by some magnetic field. So some magnetic field which you have in the disk might be some remnant from the initial field which was put down. On the other hand, here we said that also the star is producing the star is having a dipole field, or when it's very highly convective, it's a tetore, it might have even other moments, quadrupole field, or whatever can be possible here. But dipole field could then also be penetrating here of the disk. And this is certainly important for generating the jet. But I think in the largest portion of the disk, you cannot rely on these systematic fields. So they have to be self-generated from small fluctuations. It's an instability, which is amplifying the fields locally. And this is a huge discussion in the community, that some dynamo processes are increasing then the magnetic fields in the disk.
But medium is ionized.
This will be now the big problem. So of course, if you're interested only in the innermost part, up to 1,000 Kelvin, then it's wonderfully ionized. Out here, you also have ionizing sources. You have a little bit of radioactivity. You have your UV radiation, X-rays, everything, setting free some electrons. But we said before, we have dust grains. And they are basically removing all your free electrons from the gas. And this makes it very difficult. And now this is chemistry, and that's why I will not talk about it. I hate chemistry in this field. Because you have three groups which are working on the ionization fraction in the disk, and you get four answers. So it's related, of course, and this was a question before, how much we know about what the dust looks like, what is its size distribution, and as long as nobody knows this, you have wild guesses, and this reaches from active and dead regions.
It would be a while, you know, right? I mean, with the current observations.
With the observations, it's
no
very difficult, yes.
As long as we don't know conductivity, it's very difficult to say, well, this dynamo for
sending something, but
absolutely.
They shouldn't take
it. So it's really that this is now all based on theoretical modeling. So you have a model for dust growth, so then you have various processes. It's not only the conductivity, also the ambipolar diffusion becomes very important as a limit. As soon as you have so little ions floating around that they do not efficiently talk to the neutrals anymore, again, funny things occur.
So we're stuck. So currently there's no idea how to get to these particle sizes other than numerical simulations and observation, right? You cannot fly anything there because that would take too long.
Right, you have some spectral indications that they are at least at medium.
Spectral information mostly.
Right,
and
yes.
There's nothing inside that would make the situation better. Other than the modeling gets better and we understand better what the processes are that might be happening out there.
Yeah, it's all indirect, right? You see some the population plans for some property distribution properties and they try to model that. So for example, if there's a dead zone in the disk where the MRI, for example, is not operating, and it could be those as rocky bodies migrating in, they pile up on the edge of that dead zone, for example, so you see some feature in the distribution mm-hmm. of planet orbital radii. And it's all kind of
so that kind of thing. And if there's no dynamics, right, it's all static. So you get a lot of realizations, but you have no dynamics. I mean, there's basically, there's no, one has very little information about how things have evolved, right? You can see different pictures. It's like one picture.
Yeah.
You can look at it at different times, yeah, but it's
yes.
also different systems.
That's absolutely right, yes.
So you don't have one system where you can look at the dynamics, it's impossible. You can just say this one looks similar to that one, and therefore this is probably earlier, this is later, and then they cross correlations and try to figure something out.
So it's a process going over 10 million years?
Right, no, that's what I mean. It's
you can be happy if you see some characteristics of certain things.
Right, but the number of these things that we observe goes up.
Of planets, yes. Disks,
not really.
How many
do we know?
Much. It's now a question whether you talk just whether you have some spectral energy distribution. So this is certainly increasing with this new telescope. With IMR, we are thinking about how many we can spatially resolve. And there's information was somewhere up to 100 if we are very lucky.
100.
Yes. So it's this is I'm always.
It's sparse.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. So spatially resolved things. So spectral. It's a different thing, but spatially resolved.
Spectrally,
this means
100 times more.
I'm not an observer. I say 100 times more, and I might be completely wrong. So, but I think.
Who is doing these kind of observations? Where are they done?
Which ones?
The spectral ones.
Everyone who has a telescope. No, what do you mean?
I mean, is it The ones on which the models rely.
Oh well, this is work started in the 80s and 90s. So as soon as infrared detectors were available, which was only at the verge of the Cold War, when such things had been developed, infrared CCDs, then this was started.
Okay, so then there's a standard observation.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, right. Good. And so we're to find a good stop for today. So self-gravity, MHD turbulence, and maybe also possibilities for some other instabilities. I just simply call it here hydrodynamics. What is important here, in the first case, angular momentum is not being transported by viscosity. So it's not really by turbulence, but by torques. So it's basically like tidal forces that help you transport things. In the second case, it's also not really Reynolds stresses. Also, it's not this mixing length approach, but a lot of the stuff is here transported by the correlation of the magnetic fields. So your radial and your phi fields are correlated in such a way that you're producing here Maxwell stresses. And if you go to a pure hydro case, also a funny thing occurs, and this might be then a good thing to further discuss about. In this hydrodynamics, you have to generate here Reynolds stresses. You are U phi. So U phi is the azimuthal and the radial velocity fluctuations. And the interesting thing is that your disk can be turbulent, and this correlation can be positive, and then you have an alpha value. Your disk is viscous. But at the same time, this value can also be negative, which means angular momentum is not being transported outward, but inward. So in your equation, you have basically then a negative viscosity. And this, of course, would then kill the entire turbulent process. So it's not so that if you have turbulence in the disk, that you also have viscosity acting in the disk. So it's really then a question, what are the correlation properties of your velocities? And this is not just given.
I mean, to me, still this turbulence is nebulous. I mean, in other words, it's not even clear what type of turbulence it is.
Well,
here we talk a lot about isotropic homogeneous turbulence and 2D turbulence.
It's very much in the,
I think he is explaining a puzzle that was first brought up by Burroughs, namely that if you do want to have accretion torques, then the, and at the same time the kinetic energy should be sustained, then the the corresponding stress must be negative, mm-hmm. which would lead to an inverse angular momentum transport, which is the one direction. But I think this puzzle is resolved, mm-hmm. I thought at least it's resolved by restoring pressure fluctuations, mm-hmm. which Burroughs neglected.
Yeah. Right. So I just wanted to say here that just based on the fact that you have fluctuating velocities, which are some generated by turbulence, in part of turbulence, it's not said that you automatically must have this proper transport of angular momentum. But I will talk about a lot these two issues on my Friday lecture. On Friday lecture. And then just to mention briefly what we have not been talking about. I said we are doing car manufacturing, but all we have done so far is that we have grown things here up to, I said, millimeter to 10 centimeters. Those don't stick anymore. The next thing is that you are concentrating them here at pressure maxima, at edges in the disk, because it's not completely smooth. Gravity forms them into planetesimals. Planetesimals are the Lego bricks of planet formation. So you're forming a lot of them.
Yeah, there's my question. So once you have these, let's say, 1 millimeter big particles, right, you have to make out of them. I understand the planet in orbit.
Yeah.
There's a lot of gravitational force. It really sinters the material, some rocky material, mm-hmm. not just dust. There's a lot of dust on the top. But so how do we have to imagine going from 1 millimeter to a meter? And a meter for me is still powder. you know, it's a sticky powder that's coming mm-hmm. together, right? It's not a
yeah.
the gravitational. If it doesn't get heated, so it melts.
So
then it doesn't yeah. really clump up into a rock, right? So when you mm-hmm. hit things and run them in experiments mm-hmm. on top of each other, yeah. like my colleagues did in Braunschweig,
yeah.
they should shoot soot at each other and not some solid piece of grain.
Absolutely.
I mean, 1 millimeter, and sure, the 1 millimeter guys are pretty solid, probably. They, mm-hmm. But the big guys, mm-hmm. right? I mean,
that's why we say they have never been 1 meter-sized objects. So this is really the critical size up to which you can go with your fluffy, powdery things, and then you have to make a huge jump into several kilometers. Those kilometer-sized things.
Exactly. That cause the stuff to collapse.
So based from this size, then they are.
This is the main problem. How you go from millimeter to kilometer?
This is one major problem. So. There will be more bottlenecks in planet formation, but this is certainly one, yes.
And there is no idea, actually.
Of course.
That's of what course. He's talking about.
Part of this, yeah. So, but it's basically, it was already developed in the 70s, that self-gravity is taking care. So I mentioned before.
How much time it would take for self-gravity to take, I don't know, this micron-sized object, just, you know, no motion, no turbulence for the biologist. At this temperature, at this mean distances, how much time would gravity take to collapse?
So we believe right now that maybe after 100,000 years you have them. So, but
a million years for planet formation, right?
Yes, but
the typical time scale. You know the typical time scale.
There are several critical time scales. That's the problem. So the first critical time scale is to get to planetesimal at all.
Uh-huh.
Then it's a very critical time scale to get the cores, because these planetesimals are then decoupled more or less from the gas. They are dynamically interacting. And then this can take ages, that it takes already 10 million years at 5 AVU just to form the core of Jupiter. The planetesimal is several kilometers in size. It's defined that air drag or gas drag cannot remove dust from the surface anymore. So it's the first self-gravity bound object. Before that it was sticking forces. Now it's gravity bound. And yes, and there your sintering really starts, that they are melting.
That's
when the
thing starts to
really
form.
I feel we came to the most interesting part, and our time is over, so we need another hour. So maybe on Friday we somehow can